From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Assuming we go to war with Iraq and accomplish the Bush administration's goal of regime change, what will we be inheriting? On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Thomas Powers, a journalist who has written extensively about the CIA and intelligence for over 20 years. In an article titled "The Man Who Would Be President of Iraq," he writes that if we accomplish regime change, President Bush will have virtually unlimited power to change and rebuild Iraq as he sees fit. Tom Powers is the author of the new book "Intelligence Wars: America's Secret History from Hitler to Al-Qaeda." That and more coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Bush is scheduled to address the nation this evening to explain his position on war with Iraq. Administration officials say the president may use the speech to issue an ultimatum to Saddam Hussein, giving the Iraqi leader a firm deadline for going into exile with his family or facing war. Iraq's foreign minister has already rejected the possibility of Saddam stepping down. The U.S. and Britain blame France for the failure to obtain U.N. Security Council approval of another resolution on Iraq. But France says the resolution simply was opposed by a majority of the 15-member nations. NPR's Vicky O'Hara reports.
The sponsors of the resolution, Britain, Spain, and the U.S., have announced they will not seek a Security Council vote on the measure. British Ambassador Jeremy Greenstock says the sponsors concluded it was not possible to obtain a Security Council consensus. The sponsors were unable to muster the required 9 votes in favor of approval. Greenstock blamed that on repeated threats by France to veto the measure.
We believe that that particular intention to veto whatever the circumstances affected the framework for others to take their decisions.
U.S. officials have made similar statements, but the French ambassador to the U.N., Jean-Marc de la Sablière, says most council members simply felt that military action was not justified. He says a majority opposed the resolution because it led to war. Vicky O'Hara, NPR News, New York.
Australia's prime minister says his country will commit troops if the U.S. leads a war against Iraq. Prime Minister John Howard said his cabinet approved the possible deployment at a meeting today following a telephone request from President Bush. Australia already has about 2,000 troops in the Middle East. Kurds are evacuating some border towns along the front line between Baghdad-controlled Iraq and the autonomous Kurdish enclave in the north of the country. NPR's Ivan Watson reports from Chamcham Al in northern Iraq.
On every street in this frontline town, families are packing up and leaving, loading trucks, tractors, and taxis with baggage and heading north for the safety of the hills. Ahmed Hakim Shafiq and his mother push a wooden wheelbarrow full of blankets towards a waiting vehicle.
Because we are afraid we are leaving of Saddam Hussein and because of the chemical weapon and also, you know, because of the rockets.
The residents here are convinced the war will start soon and they are terrified of the Iraqi army. Perhaps to remind their Kurdish neighbors of their presence, this morning Iraqi soldiers on a nearby hill fired several machine gun rounds into the town. Ivan Watson, NPR News, Chamcham Al in northern Iraq.
And late word from White House correspondent Brian Naylor, who tells us that in his speech at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time tonight, President Bush will give Saddam Hussein 48 hours to leave Iraq or face war. This is NPR. A government report says a tracking system for monitoring foreign students in the United States is not working as it's supposed to. Congress ordered the Immigration and Naturalization Service to tighten its tracking of foreign students after the 9/11 attacks. NPR's Larry Abramson reports.
Congress ordered the creation of the CVIS database in 1996, but the Immigration Service fell behind on the system after it was learned that many of the 9/11 hijackers were in the U.S. on foreign student visas. Congress ordered the INS to get CVIS up and running by January of this year. But a report by the Justice Department says that hasn't happened. The report says it will be months before the database includes all foreign students. The report also says the government has not provided the proper oversight or enforcement to make sure that participating schools have permission to enroll foreign students. The Justice Department says the completion of the database could fall further behind because of bureaucratic challenges as the Immigration Service is absorbed by the new Department of Homeland Security. Larry Abramson, NPR News, Washington.
United Airlines has asked a bankruptcy judge to nullify its agreements with its unionized workers. The bankrupt airline went to the judge after failing to negotiate wage and benefit cuts with the unions. United asked the judge to nullify the labor contracts if the company and the unions don't reach agreement by May 1st. If the judge rules in the airline's favor, United would impose its own terms on the union. The airline is trying to keep up with a timetable imposed by the lenders who are providing United with the money to keep operating. If the airline fails to show progress in cutting costs, it could lose its financing. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from American Century Investments, offering investment solutions for individuals and institutions, including mutual funds, separate accounts, and sub-advisory services.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Assuming we do go to war with Iraq, and assuming that we win and accomplish the Bush administration goal of regime change, what future awaits us in Iraq? Thomas Powers addresses that question in an article published yesterday in the New York Times titled "The Man Who Would Be President of Iraq." Powers writes, "When the regime finally changes, 70 years of Iraqi independence will end, political authority will pass into the hands of George W. Bush, and Western rule will be planted on Arab soil for the first time since the French and British left the region in the middle of the last century." Powers is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist who's an expert on the CIA and intelligence. His books include The Man Who Kept the Secrets, Richard Helms and the CIA. Powers' new book is titled Intelligence Wars, American Secret History, From Hitler to Al-Qaeda. You know, your piece is titled The Man Who Would Be President of Iraq. Assuming we do go to war and accomplish regime change, what would President Bush's job description be in Iraq?
It's hard to tell you right now what his job description will be, because no American has ever really had a job description quite like that. Maybe Harry Truman at the end of World War II, when we became the ruling power in Japan. Essentially, he is going to be an unconstitutional monarch of Iraq. Now, he may not choose to behave like a monarch, but he's going to have unlimited power in the country to do as he sees fit.
You say you think President Bush is going to have more power in Iraq than Queen Victoria had over India. Why?
Queen Victoria had to work through a parliament, but President Bush, as the commander-in-chief of the American army, which is occupying Iraq or will be occupying Iraq, won't have to answer to anybody. That doesn't mean that the Congress couldn't get mad at him and impeach him, but it seems very unlikely. And after that, all they can do is ask him to take their views into account.
Now, what about the provisional government of Iraqi exiles?
There is no provisional government of Iraqi exiles. There are Iraqi exiles who would like to create a government or be part of a new government, but they haven't done it yet. And one reason they haven't done it is because the United States has tried to prevent them from doing it. We didn't want to have a government ready to take over.
What's your impression of what the long-term goal is of this regime change?
It's been very difficult to figure out what the government is really trying to do, because all they've talked about is disarming Saddam Hussein, which is certainly one thing that they want to do. I think the long-term goal is to fundamentally change the political landscape in the Middle East. Now, Iraq, you know, is one of the two big, potentially powerful countries in the Middle East. The other is Iran, which is right next door. We're going to be occupying the heart of the Arab and the Islamic world, and we're going to have a very large military presence there. So we're going to have a tremendous amount of influence, and I think it's the administration's belief that that will completely change the politics of the region.
How?
Well, in the first place, they will have to listen to us because we have a big army. You know, going into Iraq has been quite a stunt to get permission from the various countries surrounding it to let us do it. But I don't think we're going to need to do that again the next time. We had to ask Saudi Arabia for permission every time we wanted to fly a plane over Iraq. and we've had to ask other countries for permission. I think we're going to establish a presence there where we don't have to ask anybody's permission. And the rest of that part of the world is going to pay attention to that.
Are you saying in a way that part of Iraq's function for the United States is that it will be a big military base that we can operate from in that region?
I think that's what they've got in mind. I think they will certainly not depart in any sense without having made some kind of arrangement, roughly like the arrangement we have at the Guantanamo base in Cuba. Now, you remember at the end of the Spanish-American War, we leased the Guantanamo base from Cuba for 99 years. But when the 99 years ran out, we didn't like the government in power, which is Castro's, so we just stayed. And I suspect we're going to have a long-term arrangement in Iraq, too.
If Iraq becomes, among other things, a long-term military base for the United States, it gives the United States military a more advantageous position in that part of the world. It also makes the military and the United States more of a target in that part of the world, especially considering we'll probably be surrounded by countries that are very unhappy about that U.S. military presence.
I think the countries themselves will find a way to adjust very quickly. It's the people that may not adjust very quickly. Outsiders have tried to go into the Islamic world in the past, as you know. The first efforts back during the Crusades lasted for 100 years, and there was a period of time there when Europe thought they were in permanent control of Jerusalem. But it wasn't true. And then they went back again in the 19th century, and for quite a while they thought they were in permanent control again, that they were there to stay. But that wasn't true. It's very hard to go into somebody else's country and really stay. They have to want you. And I don't think we've been behaving like a country that they want.
The stated goal of the Bush administration in going to war with Iraq is to disarm Saddam Hussein and to accomplish regime change. Assuming that we accomplish the regime change, how do you think the American military or American intelligence might go about looking for the weapons of mass destruction that the Bush administration believes Saddam Hussein has now?
Well, I believe they'll go about it in two ways. The first way is they're going to ask the Iraqis to tell them. And once we're in power there and occupy the country, I think there's a pretty good chance that Iraqis at all levels will come forward and say, well, here's what there is and here's where it is. So that'll be the first effort. The second effort will be to use the intelligence that we do have and go and look all the places we suspect there might be stuff. And there may be things there and there may not. I'd be very surprised if the president gives a speech in 6 months' time and says, well, I guess I was wrong. They don't have anything. They're going to find all kinds of things. So that would be the first way, is to ask them to help us find it. And the second way, I believe, is that we're going to go into the files of all the relevant agencies in Iraq. The CIA would love to get its hands on the intelligence files of all the Iraqi intelligence organizations. There are three or four major ones. They've been in power for 30 or 40 years. They've been paying attention to everything. They know all about what's going on in the Middle East. And pretty soon, we're going to know all the stuff that they know.
What do you think the odds Saddam Hussein might destroy those files on the way out?
Probably he would love to do that. But you don't start destroying the files until the last 10 minutes, because you still hope you might somehow win. And the last 10 minutes don't give you enough time. Maybe you can burn a couple of file drawers full of paper, but we're talking about rooms, warehouses full of paper. And the people you're going to actually ask to destroy all this paper, well, they aren't that interested in destroying it. That's going to be something they're going to use to get jobs with the Americans. That's what happens when countries fall. Their files stay behind, and the people who keep them are the people who show you what's in them.
Well, you've read a lot of files, intelligence files, over the years. What are some of the things you think might be in these files that would be of great interest?
Well, there are going to be plenty of things of interest to the government and things that would be of interest to the world. There's going to be a lot of stuff in there about Donald Rumsfeld. There's going to be a lot of stuff
stop. What do you mean?
Well, Donald Rumsfeld made a famous trip to Iraq to meet with Saddam Hussein in the early 1980s, and I believe he was talking with them about arms exchanges and other military and intelligence relationships. And I'm sure that Donald Rumsfeld would not like those files to become public, and I don't think they will be.
What else do you think we'll be finding in these files?
Well, we're going to find a lot of stuff in the files about President Bush's father, of course, and about April Glaspie, the American ambassador at the time of the first Gulf War when Iraq invaded Kuwait. There's going to be a lot of material about that. And there's going to be material in there about Iraq's relationships with every other country in the world and with everybody who's ever sold him, you know, a rifle or something to build atomic weapons with or helped him find fissionable material. I mean, there's going to be a lot of stuff in those files.
What you're suggesting is that there's going to be a lot of interesting stuff, and some of which might be suppressed by countries that don't want part of their relationship with Iraq revealed to the public.
I'm sure that's true, and I'm sure that will be one way in which we will secure the cooperation of governments in the region.
What are some of the other things that would implicate America in these files that you think we won't be making public?
Well, we had a long clandestine relationship with Iraq during the Iran-Iraq war, where we came in on the side of Iraq and provided them with intelligence to help defeat Iran. And we've never explained what we were doing. And presumably at that time, there were American officials talking to Saddam Hussein about why they were doing this and what was the purpose. Those things would be of interest to the Iranians, for example. And then there was a lot of financial and military relationships. If you go back even further still, when Saddam came to power, there's a lot of evidence that the CIA was involved in bringing him to power. So we're very thoroughly implicated in those files from the beginning. That doesn't mean, I mean, on its face, that Saddam is not a bad actor who would be better removed from the stage. But it means that history is quite complicated and that a lot of it is stuff the Americans don't want the world to know.
What the Americans would want the world to know is information about secret stashes of weapons of mass destruction, information that Saddam Hussein was lying about. Do you think that information will be in secret files? Do you think if we get to the secret files that there will be a trail leading us to those weapons?
I think there will be lots of trails, and I definitely think we will find evidence of weapons programs that were banned by the United Nations, and he should have revealed and disbanded. If nothing else, there'll be a paper record of their first efforts to build atomic bombs, so if they ever get their hands free, they could start and do it again. I think there's going to be a ton of stuff in there. But one thing, I'm very apprehensive about what's happening here because of the magnitude of the administration's idea. But apprehensive as I am, I've told myself not to fail to be happy about the liberation of the Iraqi people. That also is a good that will come from this. There will be evil things to come from it, but that will be a good thing to come from it. And I believe when we start going into those files, we're going to find a lot of very dark stories about things that have happened in Iraq over the years. And I think those will become public. And I think there will be very little sentiment for Saddam Hussein in retrospect.
Do you think that these files will have a lot of information that will help us root out terrorists?
I do think they will have a lot of information that will help us to understand the terror network in the world. Now, whether we'll be able to follow up on it quickly and directly to arrest people, I don't know. There's some chance that will be the case. But typically speaking, people who are engaged in clandestine activities have got their ear to the ground. And when they know the CIA is going to talk to people who know where they live, they move. So I don't think anything will happen that quickly. In that sense. But our knowledge, our broad knowledge of the connections between thousands of individuals who are involved in various political and terrorist groups, that we're going to learn a lot about.
Do you have any idea what the military's plans are to secure the buildings that house the records?
I don't have any idea exactly how they'll go about doing that. The first thing they would probably do, this is a guess now, is not bomb them. I mean, you know where the paper is. You don't want to be destroying it all yourself before you can get your hands on it. So that would be the first step. But where this paper is, those locations are known, all of them. So it's not a question that they will be hunting blindly through a huge city, you know, trying to find the warehouse with the files. That won't be the case. They know the address, the street address, and they can go directly there as soon as they've got control of the country.
Are there examples you can think of ways that we were able to use files that we captured during previous wars and how those files helped us?
Well, files are something that all intelligence agencies love to get their hands on. And at the end of the Second World War, for example, we got a hold of the German files on the Russian army. And that was a huge trove of paper. And the man in charge of it, the German officer in charge of it, Reinhard Gehlen, deliberately secreted all those files away until the war was over because he knew perfectly well the Americans would want them and he could work a deal. And he did work a deal. And he was the head of German intelligence for 2 decades after being the head of intelligence against the Russians for Hitler. So files are very useful to everybody. At the end of the war in Vietnam, the United States was too slow to destroy its own files in the embassy in Saigon. So when the last helicopter took off with people clinging to the runners to escape the North Vietnamese army, we left behind a ton of paper, a ton of files, and the North Vietnamese went through there and they got the names of hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people who'd been working for us, and they rounded them all up. So files are something that people make frequent use of.
My guest is Tom Powers. He's been writing about the CIA and intelligence for over 20 years. His new book is called Intelligence Wars, American Secret History from Hitler to Al-Qaeda. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Tom Powers is my guest. He's an intelligence expert, the author of several books, and his new book is called Intelligence Wars. The Bush administration has been using the word liberation to describe what the United States hopes to do in Iraq. Another word that's been used a lot describing what will happen once we get there is occupation. Do you think liberation and occupation have really different sounds to it?
Well, they have very different sounds and they're different things. Liberation comes first, occupation comes second. You don't have to occupy a country you've liberated. You can just go away again and leave some other government in charge. But that's not what we're going to do. To liberate it means to remove the party in power, to free it from that particular oppressive regime. And it is an oppressive regime. The occupation is what inevitably happens when you take responsibility for a country. Now, we've said, for example, that one of the first things we're going to do is secure the borders. Well, we're not talking about securing the borders with Kuwait and Saudi Arabia. We're talking about securing the borders with Iran. And the border with Iran is 730 miles long. So you can't defend that border with, you know, a handful of men. That takes a lot of people. And then we've got to control that border with Turkey. The Turks have a lot of interest in what Kurds do in the northern part of Iraq. They don't want them crossing the border into Turkey, and we don't want them doing it either. And we don't want them crossing back and forth with Iran. So we're going to have people all over that country, and that's kind of what you mean by occupation. You're in charge of things. You're in charge of the police to the extent that there is any police. You prevent looting. You have to keep people from killing each other, if you can. An occupation brings with it a great many responsibilities and probably a huge expense.
Can you talk a little bit more about that importance of the border between Iran and Iraq?
The United States, you know, has a 25-year history of conflict with Iran. Ever since the revolution that overthrew the Shah and the arrival of the Ayatollah Khomeini in Iran, and not too long thereafter, relations with the United States deteriorated at a very radical pace, and the Iranians actually occupied the American embassy and held the embassy staff prisoner for a year. I mean, it was a very painful year. And it was probably the thing that doomed President Carter when he ran for re-election. That's the beginning of this history of conflict with Iran. We do not have diplomatic relations with Iran. We've had a quasi-military conflict with Iran on several occasions. President Reagan sent troops into Lebanon in the early 1980s, and Iran-backed terrorist organizations blew up our embassy and killed 60 people, and they blew up a Marine barracks and killed 241 people. Those were Iranian events, in a sense. We certainly suspected Iranian involvement. They never admitted it. So we've got plenty of things to be angry about, and those are the kind of things that a government never forgets. I mean, our government certainly hasn't forgot that. or gotten that. And we've also got suspicions that Iran was involved in the bombing of the Khobar Towers in Saudi Arabia in 1996. 19 Americans got killed there. We're mad about all that. Plus, Iran has a big, serious nuclear research program. We say it's a nuclear weapons program. And just about every objective observer, not just the CIA, but all kinds of civilian organizations agree. The Iranians are trying to build nuclear weapons. And they've been trying to build nuclear weapons at least since the Gulf War. In the Gulf War, the Iranians came to the conclusion that if you don't have nuclear weapons, you can't keep the Americans out of your country. So they're working on that. And as you know, that's the one thing that President Bush has vowed he's not going to allow. So we're going to have a 730-mile border between us and the Iranians. We got a history of conflict. We got no diplomatic relations. We want them to get rid of their programs for building nuclear weapons. And we want them to break off all relationships with what we call terrorist organizations. And that includes Hezbollah and Hamas, which are both deeply committed to getting Israel out of the West Bank. So that's a lot to ask those Iranians to do. Now, I'm not sure they're going to want to do what we want them to do. I think they probably think they'll be safer if they actually have nuclear weapons. Then maybe we wouldn't invade their country. So there are many sources of conflict, and I believe it will begin to heat up rather quickly, not in 10 minutes. It's not like we're going to go into Iraq. Next week, we're going to invade Iran. 2 years from now, the Iranians are going to be in trouble.
In the language of diplomacy, what message are we sending Iran by invading Iraq?
It's not clear to me really how Iran looks at this. You know, the Iranians had a war with Iraq that lasted for 8 years and killed 1 million people, and half of those people were Iranians, and they're mad about it. They're plenty mad about it. So they're doing something that's really unusual. They're standing aside. They hate Saddam Hussein so much that they're allowing the world's greatest superpower to come in and establish a military base next door. Now, that's not something countries normally are very relaxed about. Usually, they put up a hell of a fuss and do whatever they can to stop it, but the Iranians have done nothing to stop it. They don't trust Saddam Hussein either. In that, they share a common position with President Bush. But once we're actually there and Saddam is actually gone, that relationship, I think, is going to transform. And I think it's going to transform not because the Iranians insist on being in conflict with us, but because President Bush has said that he has demands that I don't think they're going to want to admit or they're going to want to accede to.
Tom Powers, he's the author of the new book Intelligence Wars, American Secret History, From Hitler to Al-Qaeda. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Bantam Books, a division of Random House, publisher of Tale of the Tip-Off, a Mrs. Murphy mystery by Rita Mae Brown and Sneaky Pie Brown, authors of Catch as Cat Can. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, the challenges of building a democracy in Iraq. We continue our conversation with journalist Tom Powers.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Tom Powers. He's written about U.S. intelligence and the CIA for over 20 years. His new book is called Intelligence Wars, American Secret History, From Hitler to Al-Qaeda. One of the stated goals of the Bush administration in Iraq is to build democracy. What do you think are some of the challenges of building a democracy where there has never been one?
Well, it sounds like a superhuman task, doesn't it? I mean, this is a country that's had basically dictators going straight back to the days of Babylon. That's never really had a democracy. They have had periods of time when they voted for this or that or the other, but there's always been a kind of an authoritarian central figure in charge of the country, so they're not used to it. But looking at it realistically, it's my guess that what the administration wants really is a pliant government, not exactly a client government, but a pliant government, one that accedes to our wishes on major issues and allows us access to military bases and so on that we want. I don't think we're going to turn the world upside down to try and create a democracy there. We haven't done it anywhere else, really, lately. And I don't think the administration has any real appetite for it. I think they want a government that they can control. And I think they'll probably end up with one that's got a lot of authoritarian features.
Well, somebody recently made the case on the show, Robert Kaplan, a journalist who covers that part of the world, recently made the case on the show that what Iraq will need is an interim authoritarian government that is a much kind of friendlier, more benevolent authoritarian government than Saddam Hussein. But you can't go from tyrannical dictator to democracy overnight, and a step in between would be a U.S.-supported, more, you know, more benevolent authoritarian government.
Well, you know, a benevolent authoritarian government has two aspects. It's benevolent and it's authoritarian. But, you know, as time passes, it gets less benevolent and more authoritarian. And it gets very authoritarian when you tell it now is the time to become a real democracy. So if you could establish an interim benevolent authoritarian government, I think you're basically establishing an authoritarian government. And I don't think we're going to want to overthrow another one in a big hurry, as long as it doesn't give us any trouble. So the idea of an interim government strikes me as the inevitable effort, but not promising for success.
If we create a new government, and if that government is, as you describe it, more of a client government, do you think that government is going to be under attack either by other Iraqis or by terrorists from other countries?
It's hard to say when the trouble will begin. You know, the thing that worries me about this whole episode is the magnitude of the grand scheme that the Bush administration has dreamed up for transforming the political landscape of the Middle East. You know, big ideas are the ones that give you the most trouble. And trying to make the world perfect, you know, just leads to disaster, in my opinion. And I think that's sort of been the record of human history. And whenever we've engaged in a really big endeavor, trouble comes. Now, exactly when that is going to happen, I don't know. There's going to be some kind of a government there. We're going to be there. Eventually, after the fighting stops, the dust settles, and everything's quiet for a while. And for a time, it looks like, gee, this wasn't so hard. You know, this is going to be a big success. But you've changed the fundamental relationships of people there, and gradually they realize what the limits of their action are. And they realize, well, we can't have any military forces with tanks attacking the Americans, but it isn't that hard to kind of sneak up on them in the streets. And I think sort of an endless amount of trouble will slowly begin to bubble forth. So I figure we're going to have a month of war, and then we're going to have a month of indecision, and then we're going to have a couple of months where everything looks pretty good. And then after that, things are going to start going downhill. It's going to be trouble, and it's going to be money, and it'll take a generation to resolve it.
You've been covering intelligence for decades. Do you think that the CIA is in favor of war with Iraq?
The CIA has a director, George Tenet, who has a very close personal relationship with George Bush. That would be impossible if they did not see eye to eye on this question. So in that sense, no, the CIA does not have a different view of what's going on, really, than the president has. However, all the people I talk to, And everything I've read and everything I've heard suggests that everybody who knows anything about the Middle East is full of apprehension about the demons we're going to be letting out of the closet by invading and occupying this country. And I think that includes the CIA analysts. You couldn't get anybody to go on the show and tell you that, I'm sure. But I don't believe there are very many people in the analytical department of the CIA who spent years looking at Iraq and the rest of the Middle East who say, this is the solution to our problems. Everything is going to go well. I think they're all full of apprehension.
What's some of the speculation about how war with Iraq might affect the future of terrorism? I mean, one of the reasons the Bush administration has given for going after Saddam Hussein is that the Bush administration believes, or at least it stated it believes, that Saddam Hussein has had some kind of relationship with al-Qaeda.
I believe the Bush administration really and truly thinks that the greatest danger in the world is terrorists with nuclear weapons or other weapons of mass destruction. And I think very soon after September 11th, they decided that terrorists could never get such weapons except from sovereign states, and that no sovereign state would give them to them or sell them to them except a rogue state or an outlaw state that was not really a member of the international community. And that's the whole rationale and logic, I think, about having to get rid of the government of Iraq at the moment. So in that sense, I think it'll work, and I think it will keep such weapons out of the hands of terrorists if they were likely to get them soon. But otherwise, I don't think there's any relationship between Iraq and al-Qaeda. We've tried very hard to prove it. And if we had any evidence of it, believe me, we would have used it while we've been arguing in the UN the last few months. So I don't think there is anything there. The evidence we brought forward is very tenuous, very slender. You know, some guy who's living in Iraq may or may not be involved with shooting one American in Jordan. I mean, that's not a huge relationship. I don't think there is one. I think the effect on the war on terrorism is that it's going to have two effects. All the people who are in the great pool of disaffected, politically active, anti-American terrorist types are going to be better identified and known from the files that we go through. So in that sense, our ability to track them and control them will be better. However, you think about it, what the terrorists really don't like is us there. So what we're doing is sending a lot of us right there in the middle of them. And it's just bound to lead to more trouble. It's bound to lead to more anger and more attempts to commit acts of terrorism against us. That doesn't mean that we'll see another event like September 11th, but we may begin to see a lot more smaller ones.
My guest is Tom Powers. He's been writing about the CIA and intelligence for over 20 years. His new book is called Intelligence Wars, American Secret History from Hitler to Al-Qaeda. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Tom Powers is my guest, and his new book is called Intelligence Wars. You've studied the CIA for many years, and your studies go back to an era during the Cold War when the United States covertly helped overthrow various regimes in Latin America and other parts of the world and helped put in new leaders. What kind of comparisons spring to mind for you between the difference of this overt regime change in Iraq that we're about to attempt and the covert regime change of the Cold War era?
Well, the CIA's specialty back in the 1950s and the 1960s, you know, was to target governments, political movements, countries that we had a strong interest in, and then clandestinely move in and affect the policies of those countries or overthrow their governments. But it was, generally speaking, done in a way that was deniable by the United States. We could say, well, you know, we sympathize with the goals of the rebels, but we're not actually responsible. They're not wearing American uniforms. The big difference is we are wearing American uniforms. We're going in there in the traditional way of great powers in the past, which invade and occupy. And I think the explanation, the biggest and most important explanation for this willingness to go that huge extra step is the end of the Cold War. There's nobody else in the world who can say no. You know, we were cautious during the Cold War because there were the Russians out there. We were often mad at governments in the Middle East that were backed by the Russians, and we didn't go in there openly with armies because that could have meant war with Russia. We were careful, we were cautious, and we were restrained most of the time. But now that's different. There's no check on American power. The government has this big idea that by changing governments in the heart of the Arab and the Islamic world and creating a permanent American presence there, that they can alter the political landscape. And I think they feel that it's possible because there's nobody in the world that can just simply say no. If we want to do it, we can do it. And that's the way we seem to be proceeding.
Are there differences in what the CIA knows or can do, can accomplish? Differences between the first Gulf War and this war that we're likely about to enter into and now?
I think the CIA has been, in effect, blind on the ground in both cases. I don't think we had a good intelligence network operating inside of Iraq before the Gulf War. We certainly were completely caught by surprise when Saddam Hussein actually invaded Kuwait. He'd been threatening to do something, but it was our view that it was just a bluff in order to work out a deal with the Kuwaitis. So we were wrong about that. That's a strong sign that we didn't really have a good intelligence network inside the country. And we certainly don't have a very good intelligence network inside Iraq now. We would love to have had the kind of information that would have allowed us to go to the UN and cite chapter and verse about where all these weapons for mass production were, the exact addresses, you know, who are the scientists, which ones to talk to. We didn't have that kind of information. They've been working over there for months. They've never found anything, really, that they didn't stumble across. So it's clear we didn't know where it was. We have a weakness that's developed over several decades for human sources. Actually recruiting people in hostile governments and in terrorist organizations. And it's hard to do in both cases. I mean, it's not like it's easy, but trust me, the Russians were really tough. And over the decades, we managed to recruit many very high-level, very useful, very effective spies that worked for us in Russia. So if you can do it in Russia, you can do it in the Arab world, and you can do it in the terrorist world. And we just didn't put the emphasis on that in the last 20 years that would have allowed us to know what Saddam was really doing.
Say we accomplish regime change in Iraq. We send troops to Iraq. Our troops are there. And this continues through the remainder of the Bush administration. Say, hypothetically, that in the next presidential election, somebody else was elected to the presidency, and that new president disagreed profoundly with the Bush administration policy, thought that the war had been a mistake, and wants to withdraw from Iraq. How difficult or easy is it to do something like that?
Well, once the United States has really planted itself in this country and is locked in a kind of local struggle where there are a lot of people telling us to get out and wishing we would get out, it becomes very difficult to do. I mean, we can put a new person in the White House, that can happen, and it will eventually happen, but he's going to inherit a situation. It's not one he's created, but it's not one he's going to be able to walk away from in a minute. It's very hard to leave a government that's yours. Just think of all the years we hung on in Vietnam strictly because we couldn't abandon the course we were on. We couldn't abandon the people who trusted us. We couldn't abandon the government we had created. I mean, it just went on for years and years and years that way. And I anticipate it will be very similar here. It's hard to do. It's a country of 23 million people. It's as big as Texas. We're going to have troops all over the place. And I think we're also going to be locked in a growing crisis with Iran. So I don't see how any new president could easily pull out or walk away from it, even if he hated the project from the beginning.
We've been hearing a lot about the possibility of unforeseen consequences. In your studies of the CIA during the Cold War era, when the CIA helped covertly overthrow certain governments, did you come across a lot of unforeseen consequences in those scenarios?
Every time the CIA has done anything in the world, there were unforeseen consequences. You know, we overthrew a government in Guatemala in 1954 for what seemed like smart reasons at the time. And Guatemala was racked by a civil war and wholesale strife and murder on a colossal scale for decades after that. And it was connected to what we'd done there. We were very involved in Indonesia at a time where the Indonesians and the Chinese were in a delicate relationship with each other, and it ended up with a huge massacre of maybe a million Chinese, a huge number. I forget what the number actually was. Well, the CIA has always said, well, we had nothing to do with that. But you can't really say that easily. We've been involved in lots of situations where we had a very profound effect. Most recently, you know, we organized a major resistance to the Soviet Union in Afghanistan. And the people who were in that Mujahideen army fighting the Russians, when the dust settled, have turned around and started fighting us. So that's been a factor as well. That's also been an example of an unforeseen consequence. It wasn't impossible to foresee, but beforehand it was discounted. We also trained a great many Cubans in the arts of terrorism, and one of them, a number of years later, blew up a Venezuelan airliner. Well, you know, the CIA could legitimately say that wasn't our idea, but we're the guy who trained him.
A lot of your work over the years has depended on being able to read declassified CIA documents. What is the Bush administration track record on keeping things secret or revealing information from the past and saying it's time for this to be public?
The Bush administration is very hostile to the whole idea of opening the records. And they've turned the clock back on lots of different categories of records that were slated to be declassified and made available to the public. I think making these things available is important. I agree with intelligence professionals that you can't do it quickly and you can't do it lightly. You have to look at what it is you're talking about. Sometimes people do stick their necks on the line for you, and you don't want to lightly betray them just because some reporter wants to see a piece of paper. But at the same time, it's our history. This is our country. And these things are done in our name, and we pay for them. So we have a right to know eventually roughly what's been going on there, and that means opening up the documents. Since September 11th, there have been all kinds of arguments that Homeland Security and national security and preventing terrorism make it impossible for us to release documents in the way that we used to. And it would be hard to summarize all of those different cases and say if they were all a good idea or all a bad idea, probably some of both.
What are some of the things going through your mind today when we may be on the eve of actually attacking Iraq?
Well, I'm thinking about my children's generation, which will have to pay for it over a 20 or 30 year period. And I'm also reminding myself not to forget the Iraqi people who have suffered under this dictatorship for so long. And if we go to war, I wish us success, and I hope that it works out and that somehow the Iraqi people end up happier and the world does not become a more dangerous place. But I fear the opposite.
Well, Tom Powers, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Tom Powers is the author of the new book, Intelligence Wars, American Secret History from Hitler to Al-Qaeda. Let's listen to some new music from the South African composer and pianist Abdullah Ibrahim. This is from his new CD, African Magic. Thank you. Coming up, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a new CD by drummer Matt Wilson. This is Fresh Air. New York drummer Matt Wilson has toured with saxophonists Dewey Redman and Lee Konitz, among others, and has recorded widely as a sideman since the early 90s. He also leads two quartets, one with piano or organ and one without. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says he likes the one without, especially as it sounds on Wilson's new CD.
Dazzling drummers can always get a gig, but even more rare and valuable are those drummers who are genuinely musical. Matt Wilson, for example. A good listener who gets a lively sound from the traps, he writes infectious melodies that bring out the tuneful side of the drum kit. He may place his licks at the center of the action instead of underneath it, and sometimes he'll use horns like drums to punch in rhythmic accents. Wilson does all that on his composition Swimming in the Trees, which recalls Carla Bley's repetitive but insinuating jazz tunes. Matt Wilson's quartet from their CD Humidity on Palmetto. As you can hear, he has a real knack for combining instrumental colors. He also makes good use of his forces, Andrew D'Angelo and Jeff Lederer on reeds, and bassist Yusuke Inoue, joined here and there by violin, trumpet, and trombone. Wilson has worked a lot with Ornette Coleman's disciple, Dewey Redman. That helps explain the drummer's attraction to Ornette-style jazz, with its cheerful melodies, percolating rhythms, and shifts between fast and slow tempos. He's also inspired by Ornette's swinging drummers, Edward Blackwell and Billy Higgins, with their springy patterns cribbed from parade beats and Nigerian bata drumming. This is from Wilson's Thank You, Billy Higgins. Thank you. Jeff Lederer on tenor sax. I'd hate to call Matt Wilson's music happy jazz, a derisive term usually reserved for upbeat elevator music. There is a feel-good air to Wilson's catchy tunes and exuberant beats, but his music reminds you that happiness can be a complex web of emotions, allowing for fine shadings of degree and texture. Which means this feel-good music won't leave you feeling like a dope.
Kevin Whitehead writes for the Chicago Reader and the Chicago Sun-Times. He reviewed Matt Wilson's new CD, Humidity. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Anne-Marie Baldonado directed the show. I'm Terry Gross. Tapes and transcripts of Fresh Air are available at 1-877-213-7374 or on the Internet at www.burrells.com. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Anchor Books, paperback publishers of the mystery The Number One Ladies Detective Agency by Alexandra McCall Smith. This is NPR, National Public Radio. On the next Fresh Air, our postponed interview with Scott Spencer, a novelist our book critic Maureen Corrigan describes as a brilliant storyteller. His new novel is called A Ship Made of Paper. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.